Chapter 13, The Economic Case. One would think that a moral or constitutional argument against the Fed would suffice, but rarely do Congress and the people respond to such arguments. Drumming up fear concerning economic problems usually is the way the people come around to accepting the panaceas promised by the supporters of central banking and fiat money. A lot of deception, if not outright lies, about economics must be presented to get so many people to go along. It amazes me how society has advanced technologically since the Industrial Revolution and through the benefits of great brilliance in physics, chemistry, computers, medicine, electronics, and aerospace. Nations, even with a partial understanding of how free markets work, have benefited tremendously from the abundance created. Yet with all this knowledge, few understand some of the simplest economic truths regarding money. For generations, we have been brainwashed about the necessity of having a central bank to give us a currency that is elastic. We accept the rather bizarre idea with little question. Think about this seriously. If you need money, stretch it. That is, just print more of it. It's as if we still believe that money can be grown on trees, and we don't stop to realize that if it did grow on trees, it would take on the value of leaves in the fall to be either mulched or bagged and put in a landfill. That is to say, it would be worthless. Why bright people in an advanced society can conclude that wealth can be increased by merely expanding the money supply is bewildering. I suspect that those who are the real promoters of central banking and fiat money are more motivated by power and greed than they are by sound economic theory. Many others are complacent and trusting and have probably not thought the issue through. I am convinced that I can get a 12-year-old to understand the issue of money a lot easier than someone much older. Young people are more open to new ideas. Older people are too often fixed in their ways. The total failure of the system we inherited in 1971, confirming the theories of those who believe in sound money and who predicted this outcome, has awakened a whole generation of young people to the issue of money. They realize that the mess they are inheriting is huge and easily understand how it is related to fiat money and the Federal Reserve. In spite of the tragic consequences of Fed policy for the past several decades, there is reason to believe, out of necessity, if nothing else, that sound money will be given a serious hearing in the coming years. Ludwig von Mises had it right many years ago when he predicted the downfall of all socialist economies, including the Soviet system, for a precise reason. Without a free market pricing system, there is no way to make proper economic decisions regarding supply and demand of products and services. Free market choices under socialism aren't permitted. The government sets the price and plans production. Government bureaucrats can't know what only markets can determine. Vital in the decision process is the profit-loss mechanism that rewards success and punishes failure. Government ownership of the means of production eliminates the benefits of bad decisions by business managers being punished. Under the socialism and interventionism that we have today, the successful are punished by being forced to bail out the unsuccessful. We don't have socialism of our markets yet. When we do place wage and price controls on our economy, the market economy teeters or collapses, but generally in the past, they have been removed and the economy recovers. Where we do have socialism is in money and credit and setting interest rates. This has been especially true since 1971, when the Bretton Woods Agreement ended and the dollar was delinked from gold. By manipulating the supply of money and setting interest rates, the Fed has practiced backdoor economic planning. The Fed essentially keeps interest rates lower than they otherwise would be. In a free market, low rates would indicate adequate savings and signal the business person that it's an opportune time to invest in capital projects. But the system the Fed operates discourages savings, and the credit created out of thin air serves as the signal for investors to spend, invest, and borrow excessively, compared to a system where interest rates are set by the market. This causes a major problem. A boom results, and overinvestment and excesses are built into the system, creating a bubble. A recession or depression doesn't come for some extraneous reason. It is a predictable result of the excessive credit and artificially low interest rates orchestrated by the Federal Reserve. The longer the good times last, the greater the correction will be. Our current boom, except for a few minor interruptions, has been going on since 1971. It's my opinion that it stopped in 2000. The Fed was able to create the housing bubble subsequently, but that has turned out to be the last hurrah. Today, we're witnessing the consequences of this very foolish policy. Most economists and politicians insist on defining inflation as a rising price level. Rising prices are a consequence of monetary inflation and are harmful. Mises claimed that this confusion over defining inflation was deliberate and mischievous. If it's only a price problem, then blame can be placed on profiteers, speculators, labor unions, oil companies, and price gougers. This deflects attention from the real source of the problem, the Federal Reserve and its money machine. It's because so many are convinced that consumer and producer price increases are caused by these extraneous reasons that wage and price controls are resorted to, while the Fed's role in the inflation is ignored. The silliness of this understanding is that once prices rise at an unwelcome rate, the blame is placed on a robust economy. In a free market, a robust economy causes prices to go down. A healthy cell phone or computer market, even in an age of inflation, will lower prices. Yet the Fed's solution will be to purposely slow down the economy and decrease demand to lower prices, which works with a lot of pain. This attitude reflects the shortcomings of a fiat monetary system managed by the Fed. The Federal Reserve is responsible for the boom-bust cycles. It's responsible for price inflation, recession, depression, and excessive debt. Although the central bank can get away with mismanagement of the economy for long periods of time, its policies are always destructive. Unchecked, the policies of a central bank lead to financial chaos, an example of which we are now experiencing. The fact that the Fed accommodates politicians is a good reason few challenge the Fed's authority. Spending gets members of Congress reelected by providing the goodies that constituents have become dependent on. There are limits on how much taxation the people will tolerate and how much the government can borrow without forcing up interest rates. The convenience of the Federal Reserve monetizing the debt satisfies a lot of people, until the day comes that we suffer the consequences with an economic downturn and higher prices. Higher prices represent a depreciation of the value of the dollar and are a tax on the people. The taxes borne by the middle class and the poor. The early users of the money are the beneficiaries, the government, the banks, and the large corporations. This is a deceitful, unfair, and corrupt system. Not only does it transfer a wealth from the middle class to the rich, it can postpone payments to the next generation, just as borrowing does. The bills incurred in the past two or three decades are now coming due. The inordinate amount of debt must now be paid off or liquidated. Loss of the value of stocks or homes is easily understood, but the value placed on these assets represented a gross dislocation of the system as a result of the Federal Reserve's policy. Excessive debt of a country or a people, once it reaches a certain point, is unpayable and must be liquidated. That point is almost impossible to accurately predict, since it will vary from one situation or country to another. One thing certain is that we, as a country, and probably the world, have reached that point. Individuals and corporations can default and debt is liquidated. When the need arises, liquidation is necessary and beneficial. The market today is demanding this liquidation. The politicians and the Fed are doing everything conceivable to prevent it, but they are only prolonging the agony. Governments don't default in the conventional manner. They default by debasing the currency, reducing the value thereof, through inflation. If the money loses 50% of its value, the real debt the government owes is reduced by the same percentage. This is the plan. Massive debt and inflation to bail out friends, pretending to prop up the economy, and liquidate debt. It never goes as planned. John Maynard Keynes knew that in a correction, it is necessary to lower wages. That's why he supported inflation to force real wages down and do it without confronting labor with the need to lower nominal wages. Unintended economic consequences that even the central planners did not anticipate result. The worst is economic chaos leading to political chaos that threatens not only the poor and the middle class, but the wealthy establishment as well. Wealthy corporate owners in fascist Italy and Germany did not survive the tragic outcome of the 1930s and 1940s. The economic ramifications of the Fed's inflationary policies are endless. Due to easy credit, housing prices soared above reasonable levels. Borrowing against these increased values to increase consumption was exactly what the monetary authorities encouraged. Naturally, a bubble formed and had to eventually deflate. Now, the Fed, Treasury, and the Congress spend trillions of dollars trying to stimulate housing and get the price of houses higher once again. This they do even though market forces are demanding fewer houses due to overbuilding. The central planners have become price fixers. It's not a whole lot different than imposing wage and price controls at various times to correct rising price inflation. One attempt is to keep prices from dropping. The other is to keep prices from rising. In doing either, they are eliminating the most important mechanism needed to adjust supply and demand and rejuvenate markets. This represents a grave danger. When interventionists interfere too much with free market pricing, we move toward a socialist system that in the 20th century was proven to be unworkable. The Bernie Madoff fraud case received plenty of attention, and rightly so. Adequate anti-fraud laws are on the books, and fraud is something every state is capable of handling. The fraud involved in the Enron scandal was prosecuted under Texas state law. Yet the consensus was that there weren't enough SEC regulations controlling these sort of things, even though it was active traders, not regulators, who first discovered the problem. Congress accommodated and quickly passed the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation. Just as the SEC regulations of the 1930s aggravated and helped to prolong the Depression, the bear market starting in the year 2000 has been aggravated and prolonged by Sarbanes-Oxley. The argument following the Madoff revelation of a $50 billion Ponzi scheme prompted outcries about the deficiencies of the SEC and that we needed even more SEC regulators on the job. We have 3,500 bureaucrats in the SEC, and the argument is that we don't have enough. Of course that's enough, although the truth is that 20,000 SEC regulators wouldn't suffice because they can't police every business transaction and prevent fraud from being committed. We don't expect a policeman in front of every house in the country to prevent our homes from being broken into. The idea that the SEC and more Sarbanes-Oxley legislation will protect us against evildoers in the marketplace will not help us. The idea that we can depend on the SEC to protect us significantly contributes to moral hazard. More risks are taken, believing the government will protect us, and our guard against evil is diminished. Easy credit by the Fed sets the stage for excesses, both honest and dishonest. Government insurance, like the FDIC and mortgage insurance, reassures us and the banks that everything will be safe and that we'll be protected. The current programs of endless bailouts for everyone provide plenty of incentives to take risks that most would not otherwise have taken. The government may be able to guarantee our bank accounts up to $250,000, but what it can't protect against is the devastation caused by collapsing financial bubbles and a depreciating currency. Deflating financial bubbles and inflating the cost of living are problems that only scoundrels at the Fed can deliver to us. All the regulations in the world on the economy won't help. Regulations must someday be directed toward the more deserving targets, such as the Fed, Treasury, FDIC, SEC, and the Exchange Stabilization Fund. The entire system of fiat money and fractional reserve banking is a super Ponzi-like scheme. If we can't pay it back, let's just create more, and is the source of our problems. Why should we be surprised that if our government runs a Ponzi scheme, Some people feel morally justified doing the same. When did we accept this idea that governments have license to do what they want without moral restraints, and the people must live by a different standard? The answer, of course, is that government must follow the same rules that moral people are expected to. One of the great dangers that exists once the problem breaks out from collapsing financial bubbles is the cry for protectionism. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930 is the well-known protective tariff that compounded and prolonged the Great Depression. Today, there is general agreement that protective tariffs are bad, and no one runs on a platform pushing tariffs as Hoover did in 1928. That doesn't mean there is not agitation for protection, whether it's for steel, cars, textiles, or agriculture, but hopefully a significant tariff is not in the works. The issue is that problems of trade imbalances are also a consequence of Federal Reserve policy. Our trade deficits, a very serious problem, have been compounded by our privilege of issuing the reserve currency of the world. This gives us license to inflate and export dollars as if they were gold. This, plus excessive taxes, excessive regulations, and overpriced labor, causes our jobs to be exported. We can't solve our trade problems with tariffs. They make things worse. We can't solve the imbalances without addressing the subject of money and the power the Federal Reserve has over the economy. The simplest way to understand the idea of tariffs is that, in a free country, the people have the right to spend their money any way they want. If it's to the advantage of poor people to buy tennis shoes from China, they should have the right to do so. Tariffs are illegal under the Constitution. If we had a constitutional-sized government and no welfare warfare spending, a uniform tariff to cover the cost would certainly be a better way to raise revenue than an income or value-added tax. Tariffs that protect excessive executive salaries, excessive wages, businesses that suffer from excessive taxation and regulations, or bad business decisions only prop up inefficiencies. The problems contributing to the inefficiencies must be removed. We shouldn't add another problem and another tax to the mess. Tariffs are taxes. Today, though, tariffs are less likely to be imposed. Competitive devaluations to gain an edge for exporters are common. Sound money and no central bank would prevent such a problem and diminish the need for protectionism. There are many economic ramifications of a central bank like the Federal Reserve operating a totally fiat monetary system. The power to practice central economic planning is too much for the money managers to resist, and the swollen ego of a Fed chairman only encourages mischief. The ease of financing spending by the Congress with the help of the Federal Reserve makes huge deficits a foregone conclusion. It's cheaper in the short run to inflate than it is to borrow, and much more palatable than immediate taxation to pay the bills. If a country could not borrow or inflate its currency, its government would be much smaller, and the country more prosperous and safer. Needless wars would not and could not be fought. In the long run, a seductive way to finance government's extravagant spending ends badly. It's never cheaper, and the real costs are significantly higher. Early on, it appears that it's a neat trick to pay the bills this way, and politically, it's more acceptable. But the cost to everyone concerned for the economic havoc that results from the inflationary bubbles and the corrections required are far more than anyone bargained for. Instead of a free lunch, the real costs are much higher than anybody anticipated when all the misery of a depression is tabulated. Everybody recognizes difficult economic times when the predictable recession or depression hits. The problem, though, is that with the brainwashing in economics most Americans have received, the people are unaware of the cause of the problem and the policies needed to restore the economy. Too often the people, the politicians, and the central bankers demand more of the same, more spending, more deficits, more regulations, and above all else, more inflating of the currency, none of which will be helpful. Instead, they compound the problems. People worry what would happen in a world without the Federal Reserve. My answer is that you would enjoy all the privileges of modern economic life Without the downside of business cycles, bubbles, inflation, unsustainable trade imbalances, and the explosive growth of government that the Fed has fostered. It would also disempower the secretive cartel of powerful money managers who exercise disproportionate influence over the conduct of public policy. Without the Fed, Keynesian-style macroeconomic planning that has done so much harm would be no more. I discuss this at greater length in the final chapter. Such are the benefits, but people still worry how banking might work. It would work like any other private enterprise system. Walmart might enter the market, as it wanted to, but was prohibited from doing. It would be a truly competitive system that any entrepreneur would enter. But would this be wildcat banking of the sort that is frequently condemned from the 19th century? No more so than we have wildcat restaurants or wildcat shoe companies. Markets are self-regulating, responding to the wishes of consumers. It would be the same in banking. In any case, most of the tales of 19th century banking are mythical. The problems of that century's monetary and banking system were imposed by the government. There were periodic suspensions of paying, inflationary wars, crazy price-fixing rules under the bimetallism system, and other forms of debt finance. These were problems with government, not the free market. The free market system worked rather well. In research published by the Minneapolis Fed, two scholars have looked closely at the banking system from 1830 to 1860 and found that it was remarkably stable and safe, with no widespread fraud. Bank failures were fewer than people believe, and importantly, there was no contagion effect, that is, a failure of one bank didn't spread to other banks. This is not entirely unexpected. The bad reputation of 19th century American banking, which existed during what was then the most explosive increase in prosperity ever seen in any country in the history of the world, is largely the result of turn-of-the-century propaganda agitating for the creation of the Fed. We need to look at the facts, and the facts do not surprise us once we consider that money and banking in a free market would operate like any other normal business enterprise, subject to profit and loss tests, and punished or rewarded in the market based on consumer behavior. We no more need to worry about banking in a post-Fed era than we worry about groceries, shoes, or software now. They are provided by the market and not some distant central planning apparatus that possesses neither the knowledge nor the incentive to do it well. To save ourselves from economic and political disaster, a dramatic change in the conventional wisdom of economic policy by our leaders is vital. Fortunately, our numbers are growing, and more people than ever, especially young people, are now aware of the menace we face from the Federal Reserve and understand the importance of sound money.